genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Every show has a theme, and today's theme is all business all the time. We're talking with Brad Butler about the upcoming midterm elections in our first segment. My next guest believes that the U.S. housing market remains one of the weakest links in the economy. He'll explain what the temporary moratorium on foreclosures means for the housing market and for the economy. If you're interested and you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Mike Larson has seen a little bit of everything in the decade that he's been following the interest rate, housing, and mortgage markets. Mike got his start in the financial markets at Bloomberg News, a very good, reputable organization, while he was still in college. He graduated from Boston University with a BS degree in journalism and a BA in English, and went to work for Bankrate.com. Mike joined his current employer, Weiss Research, in 2001, and has worn a number of hats at that company. He's been an analyst, a writer, a trader, an editor. And welcome to the show, Mike. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
Doing terrific, Mike. Thanks so much for joining us here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Let me just set the stage for the listeners, if I can. About 8% or 4.2 million homes are either 3 months past due or in some state of foreclosure in the United States today. That's according to Moody's. About a third of the sales of existing homes in the U.S. is coming from foreclosed houses. So there's talk in all of the financial publications about potential problems if the foreclosure process is stopped. And we had the temporary moratorium on foreclosures during the time that banks like Wells Fargo and others examined their paperwork and was found to be wanting. So Mike, let me ask you, what are the problems if the foreclosure process stops or is slowed down?
Well, I think we need to recognize that this is a housing market that's dominated by the sale of distressed homes. Anywhere in some markets, anywhere from 30 to 40% of all the sales being done are short sales or foreclosures, REO sales where the bank's already foreclosed and then is reselling the house. I mean, this is what's helping on some level to clear the inventory overhang. The reality is a lot of these borrowers, despite aggressive modification efforts and what have you, just aren't going to be able to hold on to those homes. They need to go back and be renters and repair their finances. And you need to sell those homes at lower prices to new buyers who can then, you know, have an affordable mortgage payment and can not just get into that home but stay in that home. If you gum up the works and prevent that process, that necessary, you know, crunching of the debt, transfer of the home from, you know, an overburdened borrower to a new one who can ostensibly stay in that home, you're really going to see a big impact in terms of home sales, and you're going to, you know, essentially cut the knees out from under a third to almost a half of the market in some places.
All right, I can see that. And certainly this is really just the unwinding of the debt crisis that we got into in the housing market. Let's just recap that history if we can for a second here. Back in 1998, President Clinton made it a mandate that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae should buy loans from private banks, basically then making them the guarantor of those loans. In 2001, President Bush declared that home ownership is something that every American should be afforded. He and then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan proceeded to keep interest rates at unrealistically low levels for a long period of time. Aren't the foreclosures that we're talking about really just that unwinding of a decade of bad economic policies from the federal government?
Oh, absolutely. We have the federal government that, you know, overstimulated the housing market, tried to get everybody into a home without really thinking about whether they could stay in that home. You have the Federal Reserve that kept rates too low for too long, and that kind of gave the raw fuel for an explosion in mortgage lending. You have the banking industry, which really just abdicated its responsibility and gave loans to anybody with a pulse. And you have the regulators that, you know, were supposedly overseeing what these banks were doing, basically saying, hey, you don't have fun, do whatever you want. We're not going to get in your way. And we had borrowers that were swept up in the speculative frenzy and took on too much house, more than house than they can afford, buying two, three, four condos at a time. So really, you know, almost everybody has a hand in this somewhere. And when you have a bubble the size of the one that we did, there's going to be all kinds of fallout. There's going to be bank failures, which we're seeing, you know, every Friday night. There's going to be declines in the value of homes, which we're seeing on a widespread basis. There's going to be a lot of borrowers that can't hang on despite modifications, and they're going to lose those homes. And that process is going to play out whether we like it or not. You know, the only real permanent solution for this would be if somebody could invent a time machine, go back to 2002, 2003, when this thing was just getting started, and put a stop to it. So we are going to be dealing with the fallout of the housing downturn for some time, and there is no easy fix.
We're talking to Mike Lawson, everybody. He's an analyst over at Weiss Financial, and we're talking about the mortgage industry. Now, let's compare the situation in the United States today, Mike, with what was going on in Japan in the 1990s, because Japan had essentially a similar type of problem in the 1990s. How is it the United States situation is different from that in Japan? Because this is led to Japan's about 20 years of just really moribund growth in their economy.
Sure. If you look at Japan, you had twin busts there in their equities market and then real estate shortly thereafter. You had, you know, the Bank of Japan supposedly dragged its feet in trying to, you know, cut interest rates and so on. But eventually it got to 0% interest rates. It got to a point where it was doing quantitative easing. Many of the same things, frankly, that we're doing here. It just the U.S. Fed believes it's doing things sooner and more aggressively, and therefore we won't suffer a Japan-like outcome. I'm somewhat less optimistic. I think that what happened in Japan, many of the same things are happening here. Again, twin busts in equities and real estate, just with more space between them than you had in Japan, the passage of time, that is. If you look at what's going on there, many of the Japanese banks were called so-called zombie banks, were kept alive with artificial support. They were allowed to extend the terms of loans and take government bailout money rather than just fold. You know, if that sounds familiar, it should. And I think that, you know, it's likely that the U.S. I don't think things will be as bad as in Japan. There's differences in culture, differences in ways that we go about doing business. But I do think that a longer than expected period of lackluster growth, higher unemployment, a housing market that doesn't have to collapse again from here, but also probably won't see a vigorous recovery, I think that's probably what's in the cards for us over the next few years.
Well, let me ask you to put some historical perspective on this, Mike, then. If we're into a period of slow or no growth, protracted house prices maintaining at a level, basically a level situation, aren't we going back to the 1970s and where we were with President Ford and Jimmy Carter?
It does seem like it's going to be an era where just the sort of American spirit, American optimism, the belief that, you know, your kids are going to have a better life than you do, it's very hard to maintain that in this kind of environment. We've got you know, a little bit of the worst of both worlds in that we have slow growth. We also have, as a result of the Fed's money printing, some, you know, commodity inflation. Wages aren't keeping up because unemployment remains high, but the cost of fueling our car and wheat and soybeans and corn and on is all going up. So, yeah, it's an environment where I think there's going to be a period, a tough period that we're going to have to go through, and it's almost like a hangover as a result of all the easy money and the easy money fueled booms that we saw in housing and so on. Now we have to kind of pay the piper for that, and you know, it doesn't mean that the world's coming to an end. We'll get through this period, but it will be a different era certainly than what we saw, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
We're talking to Mike Lawson, everybody. He's an analyst over at Weiss Research. Mike, let me ask you this: you brought up the rising commodity prices. Now, we know that fuel has been bouncing around in a fairly narrow range, and it's only at about $78 a barrel, I believe, right at the moment. No, that's the dollar index, excuse me. But fuel has been bouncing around in a narrow range. The soft commodities, cotton, wheat, all of those things have really gone through the roof. We haven't seen the corresponding inflation, though, at the consumer level for those. So my question to you is, are the commodities prices that are going up so fast the next bubble to burst?
Well, I think what's going on there is clearly just reinforcing of a theory that we've seen proven a few times now. The Fed can create money, it can print money, but it can't really direct where those funds are going to go. You know, keeping the liquidity tap wide open in the late 90s helped to give us, you know, help being a contributing factor for the dot-com boom. In the early 2000s, the Fed easy money that was done in response to the dot-com bust helped fuel a housing boom. You know, now in response to the housing bust, you've got the Fed saying, well, we're going to open the taps, we're going to, you know, buy several hundred billion dollars worth of bonds, we're going to do this quantitative easing and on, and what's happened? And since the Fed started opening its mouth about this, the dollar's fallen more than 10%, and as you pointed out, soft commodities and things like gold and copper and so on have taken off. You know, at the same time, real estate's gone nowhere. So once again, you have the Fed trying the same quote-unquote solution of easy money, but it's not helping the market that it wants to help. It's just bleeding out elsewhere. It's moving overseas to stronger economies. It's helping inflate commodity inflation. So I think, you know, on some level, hopefully the Fed will get it and realize that easy money is not the solution for every problem that ails us.
Ah, okay. Now, the Bank of Australia has raised their interest rate. The Bank of Britain is probably going to raise their interest rate. The FOMC, which is the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, is coming up, I believe, next week sometime. What do you think is going to happen with interest rates in this country?
Sure. As much as I wish the Fed would get it and you know try changing its approach, it doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. We're going to have, in my opinion, this ZERP policy, zero interest rate policy, for as far as the eye can see. And on top of that, we're going to get some kind of program of printing money and buying bonds. I wouldn't be surprised if it's, you know, starts out at a $500 billion level spread out over several months, and they'll keep the ability to ramp that up or down as they see fit. So I think what that's likely to do, unfortunately, is weaken the dollar. It's going to give us more of this commodity inflation. The Fed believes deflation is evil at all costs, but I would argue that all they're giving us is bad inflation. You know, with unemployment as high as it is, it's not like there's going to be commensurate wage increases to go along with these increase in living costs, whether it's fuel, whether it's everything we talked about earlier, the cotton, the wheat, the soybeans, and so on. So you're going to have some price pressure. You know, your grocery bill is going to go up, your gasoline bill is going to go up, but your wages aren't going to go up as much.
So yeah.
In a sense, I think what the Fed's doing is not the right policy, but it's the policy we're going to get anyway.
Well, two things I want to ask about. First of all, the dollar. You mentioned the weaker dollar. Yes, the dollar is weaker. It had a period of strength there towards the end of the summer, but now it's weakened again. And that's maybe not such a bad thing, because when the dollar is weak, U.S. exports are very attractive. And so all of a sudden, our automobiles are being consumed in China and places in India, places like that. They sold more Chevrolets in China this past quarter than they did here in the United States. So those are fantastic for companies that export. Why is a strong or a weak dollar matter to the economy, Mike?
Well, I think that the problem with the weak dollar theory, and yes, I agree that it does support exports on the margin. The problem is that against something like the Chinese yuan, it's not really moving. It's gone down a little bit, but nowhere near what you would need to see to correct sort of the disparity in competitiveness there. I mean, our labor markets, our export markets are nowhere near as competitive as the lower cost environment that you have in China. So unless you see a very large currency move there in that pair, which I don't think China will allow to happen, we're not going to get as much bang for our buck. So it'll help to some degree, but I also think, on some level, if it's also going to give us this other, this inflation that we're dealing with, and it sort of reduces our real standard of living in this country, I think it's a little bit of a devil's bargain, and we're not going to get much. We're not going to get much out of it.
We're talking to Mike Lawson, everybody, and he is just a ray of sunshine today, let me tell you. Let me ask you this, Mike, though, and this is the follow-on question. You were talking about the Fed and its printing money and the cycles that we've gone through. And let's think about it. Just in this first decade of the 21st century, we had the Y2K scare. Then we had the dot-com boom and the dot-com bust. We had Enron, WorldCom, and Global Crossing debacles that went on. We had the rise of the housing market, the deflating of the housing market. And it looks like we might be headed towards a bubble in commodities. We don't know that yet. So, I mean, are these cycles, this rapid turnover, these booms and busts, is that going to be the way that our markets are going to react for the next decade or two?
You know, I think it is. We had this period of so-called great moderation in the 80s and 90s where things were relatively stable. It was, you look at any chart for any assets in the economy, it was kind of up and to the right. And since then, since the dot-com bust and really in the decades that's followed, we've had much more volatility. We've had, much less net progress in many areas. So I think, yeah, that's probably the environment we're going to be dealing with. It doesn't mean that there aren't ways to make money as an investor. I mean, again, you've seen things like gold in a long-term bull market, and certainly you can profit from that. There are things like emerging market stocks and currencies, which have done very well. So there are ways, even if I'm relatively bearish on the outlook for the U.S. economy, it doesn't mean that you as an investor can't make any money. You just need to adjust your investment strategy. So I think that's what people are going to have to get used to. I think that the buy and hold, long-term bull market U.S. environment that we had for a couple of decades is probably over. So people just need to adapt.
All right. Well, you bring me to my very next question, and that is there's always a bull market somewhere, Mike. So if the housing market and the mortgage industry are unwinding, where's the next bull market going to be?
future, I think that in the very short term, we're probably going to see some of these commodities correct. We're going to see the dollar maybe bounce a little bit. And I think there may be the risk next week of getting a little bit of disappointment in the size of what the Fed does. But I think ultimately, if the Fed's going to be running this easy money policy, if they're going to be purposefully debasing the dollar, even though they won't come out and say it, then I think you're going to see a continuation in the trends that we have. You're going to continue to see things like precious metals look very good. You're going to continue to see emerging market currencies do well. And you're going to see money migrate from where it's not being treated well, and that would be the developed economies with very low interest rates and weaker growth, into markets where it will be treated better, where interest rates are higher, where the return on capital is better, and where the growth prospects are better. So I think that that means as an investor, you've got to have more overseas exposure than you would have otherwise. You probably want to be underweight U.S. and European stocks versus emerging markets, and you definitely want to hold things like gold as protection against what's going on.
Ah, but you bring up an interesting point, Mike, in talking about where you're going to find the next bull market in some of these more sophisticated investment vehicles. And the pendulum is certainly starting to swing. You alluded to it before. The 90s, the 80s, the 90s, those were fairly stable growth in the United States. You could simply buy something and hold on to it, and it would grow, and you would get wealthier because of that. And most everybody did. You know, whether they did it directly themselves or whether they did it through their 401k or their pension plan, people were investing in the stock market. Now, all of a sudden, the pendulum is starting to swing. The layperson doesn't know how to invest in foreign markets necessarily, certainly don't know how to invest in commodities or how to invest in derivatives. So are we returning to a time where you're going to have the financial elite running the financial markets, or is it a game that everybody, every investor can play in?
Well, I think with the right education and the right knowledge, it's those other types of markets beyond just, your large cap U.S. stocks that worked so well for so long are much more accessible. I mean, we have, thanks to the explosion in exchange-traded funds, exchange-traded notes, and other things like that, I mean, you can go out and buy palladium if you want to without opening a futures account. You can go out and buy the Malaysian stock market just using a regular ETF that trades under a ticker symbol EWM. There's all kinds of new tools that the industry has created that make those types of markets much more accessible to your average guy who just may have an IRA or a self-directed brokerage account. So it's just a matter of getting the knowledge, researching what products are out there and putting that plan into action. You don't need to use a lot of the more sophisticated, expensive, and frankly risky things like futures and options that you would have had to use previously.
All right. We're talking to Mike Lawson, everybody. He's an analyst over at Weiss Research. And final question, where we're going to return back to the housing industry, Mike. And looking at home building is absolutely moribund right now. The mortgage interest rates, however, at an all-time low. So what is it going to take to change the direction of the housing market and put us back on the right track there?
Sure. I think the main issue, the main thing that's going to help turn this thing around is also the most boring, and that's simply the passage of time. We need to slowly transition homes from overburdened borrowers to new borrowers who are buying at lower rates and lower prices and therefore have affordable lasting payments. We're going to need to crunch some of the debt on these houses that now aren't worth what they were when those loans were made. We're going to have to slowly recapitalize the banking industry to the point where it feels ready to take risks again in the mortgage lending arena. And frankly, we just need to get over the psychological damage that's been done. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, everybody was talking about their tech stocks at cocktail parties, and now, 10 years later, do you hear that? No, you don't. And it's just, I think something similar is going to happen in real estate, where because people were burned, there's going to be a reluctance, even when financially it might make sense, a reluctance for people to jump into home ownership. So it's going to be a long healing process. I think that's what we need to steel ourselves for, is a relatively low level of home sales, low level of home prices, although probably not much more deterioration, and just an environment that where housing goes back to being a boring asset again, and I think that's what we'll see over the coming years.
So it's just going to take the passage of time. Well, we'll have to see about that, Mike. We'll check back in with you as time passes on to get an update on not only the housing markets but interest rates as well. Thanks so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great. Thank you.